Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Nelson Mandela, the secret of his appeal. This Wednesday is Nelson Mandela Day and the 94th birthday of the former South African president and Nobel laureate. And we examine why Mandela is so revered and find out why, as president, he had trouble obtaining some chocolate for his grandchildren one Christmas Eve. And Nigeria violence escalates. Christian Solidarity Worldwide, an NGO that campaigns for religious freedom, warns of growing religious polarization in Nigeria.
I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live and to achieve, but if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die,
People around the world, and South Africans in particular, are marking Nelson Mandela Day on July the 18th, the 94th birthday of the nation's former president and Nobel Peace Prize laureate. Jailed for 27 years for leading the struggle to replace the apartheid regime with a multiracial democracy, Mandela was elected South Africa's first black president in 1994. Since then, he has played a pivotal role in promoting reconciliation in his homeland and also has been active in working for peace in areas of conflict around the globe. South Africa's leading Catholic churchman is Cardinal Wilfred Napier, Archbishop of Durban, who spoke to me about Nelson Mandela's greatest gifts as a man and as a leader.
I greet you all in the name of peace, democracy and freedom for all.
I think one of the greatest qualities is that Mandela as a man was somebody who knew how to give himself for the cause of freedom, and that freedom included everybody. And as a result, because he was doing it for others, he was completely free in what he was doing. And I think that's what added to the integrity of the man in his participation in the armed struggle. He was genuinely doing it for others. And that seems to be one of the greatest attributes of the man. He is very much a man who is concerned about others. I would say even his membership of the ANC, his leadership in the ANC, was always to make himself available for and to the other.
You've met him in person on a number of occasions. I mean, how would you describe him? How would you describe his personality when you come face to face with him?
The first thing was he has a phenomenal memory. You meet him once, next time you meet him, he doesn't need to be introduced to you. He will certainly remember you, remember details of where you come from. And in that way, he's very typical of that generation. They were always very interested in other people. And what was good for other people would become the object of why they were engaging with you. The second thing, he comes across as a very, very humble man. Humble in the sense that he knows he is in the position that he is because he has been given gifts to be in that position, and he acknowledges that those gifts are not of his making, but his creator has given him those gifts. I think the third thing I would say about him is Mandela was always somebody who kept very much in touch with his people, from the smallest ones to the greatest ones, the lowest to the highest. And I think that really is a feature of the man. He's really there for his people.
Is there any particular remark that he made during those meetings that particularly resonated with you, particularly memorable or inspirational?
Yes, the one was not in a meeting as such, but on a phone call. After the news had got out that I'd been appointed a cardinal, He was out of the country at the time, but he got his people to track me down. Eventually, they tracked me down to the seminary that we were having our bishops' conference meeting in Pretoria at. And when we eventually, after 2 or 3 days of trying to get hold of each other, we made contact, and I greeted him. First of all, I said, "Mr. Mandela." He says, "No, I'm Madiba to you." So another more familiar way of addressing him, you see. And then he said, "Oh, imagine, Cardinal Napier, you calling ordinary folk like myself, and you've been elevated so high in the church." You know, he's that kind of man. Very much in his mind, to affirm others was more important than receiving accolades from anyone.
And if you had to sum up in just a few sentences, what are his greatest contributions to South Africa's history?
I think he went against the tide. At the time that he was in prison and the armed struggle was getting very, very vicious, Mandela took it upon himself to make contact with the authorities, the government, and started telling them that the path that was being followed was leading to absolute disaster. It was time that we started meeting and talking to each other. I think that kind of initiative that showed the qualities of leadership that I think we're lacking very, very badly at the moment, not just in South Africa, but I think in many parts of the world as well. That quality of leadership that sees disaster coming and says, "We have to take drastic action. Even if it's against the stream, we have to do it." And that's what he did. The second thing that's outstanding about Mandela was the way in which he was able to evaluate situations. For instance, the ANC was terribly anti the World Cup and the rugby and all that. They wanted the name of the Springboks to be changed and a whole lot of other things. Mandela saw that this was actually going to cause more harm than good, went to a meeting, put his leadership on stake by saying, "If you go this route, then I'm going to resign as your leader." And it was a very close thing, but he showed his leadership there. And the final thing I would say about Mandela was, when he saw the opportunity, he used gestures, symbolic gestures, admittedly, but gestures that would speak more than 1,000 words. For instance, organizing to have high tea with the wives of the former prime ministers and presidents of South Africa who had been the cause of his incarceration and who had been the architects of apartheid and its oppressive system. He had tea with them as a symbol of reconciliation. I think those are some masterstrokes in his life. And it's that kind of thing that makes me enthusiastic about speaking about Mandela.
I was speaking there to South African Cardinal Wilfred Napier.
Let us remind ourselves that our work is far from complete. Where there is poverty and sickness, including AIDS, where human beings are being oppressed, there is more work to be done. Our work is for freedom for all.
Another Catholic churchman who has met Mandela many times is Father Sean O'Leary, director of the Dennis Hurley Peace Institute in South Africa. He shared with me the humorous and heartwarming story of why President Mandela experienced some trouble in obtaining some chocolate for his grandchildren on Christmas Eve in 1994. But I began our interview by asking why, in his view, Mandela is one of the world's most revered statesmen.
I would think it's because of his personal experience as a man. When you consider that he spent 27 years in jail and not under good conditions, and when he walked out of that prison in 1991, and his first message to South Africa was one of reconciliation and not revenge, one of unity and not division, the people immediately warmed to the person that fit very much with the image that people had, because his name was synonymous around the world with people who had fought for what is right and paid the ultimate, not quite the ultimate price, but paid the price of being 27 years incarcerated. And I think the image fitted the man, and together, if you like, in those words of Seamus Heaney, for once, the long-for tidal wave of history dawned and hope and history rhymed in that sense.
Now, you've met Nelson Mandela many times. What, for you, are his greatest qualities? I mean, is there some characteristic of his that really struck you at these meetings when you were meeting him face to face?
Well, I was a priest in Soweto when he was released in 91, and he came out on a Sunday. He came to Soweto on the Monday, and a small delegation from my parish went down to his house to greet him. And it was almost that he was kind of speechless by the fact that people were coming to see him. He couldn't understand it. And I think that humbleness, that meekness struck me very much. As the years went by, we began to meet at different functions. And I was very chuffed that he would even remember my name. And he would always call me Father Sean.
He's also got quite a good sense of humour, hasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, have you had? Can you give us any examples of that?
Now, I'll just tell you very quickly. In January 95, he was president. And he would call church leaders' meetings like 2 days before. And normally it should be Cardinal Napier or the Secretary General of our Bishops' Conference, but both were away. I was then running the Justice and Peace Department, so I was asked to go. The meeting was very early at 7 in the morning, but I got there very early. And the people told me, look, go up to the room and there's some breakfast available and make yourself whatever you want. I had just got in, and in walked Mandela. It was just the two of us. So he says, how are you? And I said, I'm well. And he took a cup of tea, I took coffee, and I said, well, how was your Christmas? And he said, let me tell you a little story. He says, I was in the presidential office on Christmas Eve, and I felt I should give all my staff the afternoon off so that they could go and shop and prepare for Christmas. And I was left with a bodyguard and a driver. But I realized that I was having my grandchildren over for Christmas Day, and I'd nothing for them. So I took out the phone book, and I rang one of the chocolate factories. And I said to the young lady who answered, I said, this is President Mandela. I need to talk to somebody about chocolate. And she said, I don't like you intimidating and trying to mock our president. And she put the phone down. And then he asked his bodyguard for the name of another factory to make chocolate. And he rang again, and he said, please take this number down. It's the personal number of President Mandela. And ask one of your managers to ring me back. Which they did. He explained his predicament, and they said they would have a truck around within an hour, which they did. So he duly went down, took all the chocolates he needed, put them into the boot of his state car, and the chap said, well, that's a present from us. And he said, no, I insist on paying. So they wrote up an invoice, and then they gave it to him, and he said to me, I had no money on me. I had borrowed the money from my driver. And he found that to be a very funny story, which I did as well, and a very human story.
Yes, he certainly comes across with a great charisma. And as you said, he's totally without bitterness, isn't he, for this very harsh treatment that he had, you know, spending 27 years behind bars. Did he ever talk about that period with you?
No, he doesn't in general refer to that. He did tell us once, but we were a group at the time, that he realized that there was no way forward, and this is very important for South Africa, without, if you like, the Afrikaner or the white person. And so he set himself a task while in jail to learn their language, which we call Afrikaans, which meant that when he did begin to dialogue with the government, even when he was still in jail, he spoke to them in their language. And that, he said, for him was very important because they were absolutely amazed that he could converse with them in their own language.
We have traveled a long journey. We have fought for peace and reconciliation, for social justice, for all men, women, and children to live together in harmony and with equal opportunity. These are ideals I still believe in, ideals that I still live for. By the time has come to fully hand over my work, memory is a vital force in the life of people and nations and can help unite divided societies.
Since stepping down as president, Nelson Mandela has been involved in a number of peace negotiations in other countries, in Africa and elsewhere. And he's also campaigned against HIV/AIDS, which, of course, is so prevalent in South Africa and has touched even his own family. In fact, many people were struck by how open he was about the disease and not hiding the fact that his own son died of AIDS. I mean, this is breaking a taboo, really, isn't it? And it's another example.
It is indeed. It is indeed. One of the most important aspects of Mandela after his release was his love of children. He said that the greatest thing he missed while in jail was the sight and sound and laughter of children. And so he set himself a personal goal to make sure that he would do as much as he could to improve the life of children throughout the world, but particularly in South Africa. And one of the areas that affected him most was the fact of young children being born with HIV/AIDS and dying at a very young age. And he has done a tremendous amount of charity with the Nelson Mandela Foundation, which is, if you like, targeted towards helping children in many aspects throughout the country. And I think his way of dealing with things is to be honest, upright, and to acknowledge that HIV/AIDS is the scourge of our century.
Mandela Day, of course, always falls on his birthday. How is Mandela Day being celebrated throughout South Africa?
You could argue that the National Day of South Africa is the 27th of April when we had our first election in 94. But the 18th of July is far more popular in the minds and hearts of the people. There is a campaign called the 67 Minutes, where everybody, including institutions or individuals, are asked to do something charitable in the name of Nelson Mandela. And schools, factories, and universities, everyone seems to have a little contribution to make the country a better place. Everybody is aware that this is Nelson Mandela's birthday. And everybody is aware that they are called upon, in the name of the great man, to make a small contribution towards making the country a better place, and in particular, assisting and helping the more marginalized people in our society. And I think that's the impact of his birthday, that it is a pouring out of all that is good in the minds and hearts of a nation to visibly show that they care about their brothers and sisters. And I find that extraordinary.
And how do South Africans view Mandela? I mean, is he admired by everybody no matter what?
I think so. I would say, you know, it is fair to say that I doubt he has any enemies. Even the most right-wing of the old guard, we call, of the old racist government, would still have a tremendous respect for Mandela. Though they may not accept the present government and the present President Zuma, somehow Mandela has risen beyond all that and has become an icon of truth and hope for a new country.
And finally, what for you will be Mandela's greatest legacy? Or put it another way, if Mandela had not been around, how different would the history of post-apartheid South Africa have been?
Well, I think, I mean, we see it throughout the world. Leadership is the issue. Bad leadership produces countries in turmoil, as we say now in Zimbabwe. Good leadership does the opposite. It liberates countries. And I think that's what Mandela did personally. By his charisma, by the person he is, he liberated South Africa from the shackles of the past, which were shackles that were based on racism, division, to a united country where love and respect reigns. Maybe not totally, but surely tremendously different from the post-90 period.
I was speaking to Catholic priest Father Sean O'Leary in South Africa about the figure of Nelson Mandela.
We are humbled by the call for an annual Mandela Day in our honor. Our struggle for freedom and justice was a collective effort. Mandela Day is no different. It is in your hands to create a better world for all who live in it.
In Nigeria, the radical Islamic group Boko Haram has killed hundreds of people, mostly Christians, this year, including several suicide attacks on churches. Much of the violence has taken place in the central plateau state, where the mostly Muslim north of Nigeria meets the largely Christian south. In the most recent incidents, Boko Haram claimed responsibility for attacks that killed at least 65 people on July the 7th in Plateau and for the assassination of two prominent politicians at a funeral for the victims the following day. But how do Christians in Nigeria view this escalating violence? And why is the government so far unable to crack down on those responsible? To find out, I spoke to Dr. Kataza Gondwe, an expert on African affairs at Christian Solidarity Worldwide, an NGO that is working for religious freedom. She gave me her assessment of the current situation.
Well, it is pretty worrying. We are very concerned. The killings have been mostly by Boko Haram recently. This is the Islamist militant group. And they have also claimed responsibility for the first time, whether this is true or not, for killings that have been going on in some of the central states on a regular basis since 2010. There have been attacks, we thought initially, by Muslim herders or Muslim Fulani men armed in some sort of way, have been attacking villages in Plateau State in particular, and also in Bauchi State, and more recently in Kaduna State. And these villages are attacked at night by heavily armed men who kill entire families in some cases, and in the most recent case have killed close to 200 people. So it is pretty worrying. And then at the same time, you have the bombings and suicide bombings, more recently a car bombing, and attacks by armed men on church services by Boko Haram, definitely. So it is a pretty worrying situation.
I mean, would you agree with those that say Boko Haram is trying to fan religious conflict in the country, particularly because it seems to focus on areas where there are already pre-existing religious tensions?
Well, I think they're just fulfilling their agenda. From the beginning, when they were created in 2002, they actually said their agenda was the Islamization of Nigeria. And that when they say Islamization, they mean the kind of Islam that their founder espoused, as opposed to the Islam that is traditionally there in Nigeria. And the example of them wanting to, you know, enforce their own version of Sharia is the recent suicide bombing attempt, which was really an assassination attempt that took place in the central mosque, or outside the central mosque in Borno, where the Shehu of Borno, who's the second highest traditional Muslim leader in Nigeria after the Sultan of Sokoto, was targeted along with the deputy governor. So they're just fulfilling their mandate, which has been the same from the beginning. And as part of that, they began by attacking Christians in 2003 onwards, and they're just continuing that. And that, in turn, is fanning more flames of anger, you know, that were already there. But I wouldn't say they were deliberately doing that, an outworking of their agenda, really.
And how would you describe the mood of Christians living in these areas? Are they very frightened?
Well, yeah, there's fear, there's apprehension. There's a determination to still go to church, even though the chances are that the church service may be attacked, because you never know where these people are going to attack, when these people are going to attack, and which church these people are going to attack. So with the proliferation of churches in Nigeria, it's difficult to protect them adequately all at the same time. So yes, there is fear, there's apprehension, but there's also determination to keep going. But it's not an easy situation at all, because something can happen at any time. And in fact, even during our most recent visit to Nigeria, we nearly got caught up in a roadside bomb. So it's that, you know, random, it's that often, and it can happen at any time.
And do you think the government is doing all that it can do to stem this violence, to, you know, try to track down those who are the ringleaders and bring them to justice?
Well, in terms of the village attacks, which I'll put separately, because there's still some dispute over whether Boko Haram were responsible for that Although this time, the most recent attack in Plateau State, which claimed over 100 lives and eventually a secondary attack on the following day that claimed the lives of members of parliament, was distinct in that the people who were doing the attacking now had bulletproof vests. I mean, they were always heavily armed, but this seems to have stepped up again. And it would appear that the deaths of members of parliament, the federal parliament, may have finally galvanized some kind of effective action. Because the people, particularly in Plateau State and even in Bauchi State, whose villages were being attacked, would say these people have a camp in a certain area and they're training people there. But nothing was done to, you know, send troops or forces into those camps and disrupt this training. And now the whole thing has escalated to what we saw recently. So, as I was saying, the deaths of the members of parliament seem to have galvanized some kind of effective action. And the special task force in Plateau State that's charged with security of the state has asked 6 villages in the areas where, you know, the village attacks are taking place to evacuate. Now, these villages happen to be inhabited by Fulani Muslims. And they are now protesting, saying they're being run off their land. But the army is saying, you have 48 hours to leave because we're going to be undertaking intensive in the area to find the hiding places of these people and tackle them. So suddenly there is a seriousness in the pursuit of the people who attack villages. Hopefully that would be of use. In terms of Boko Haram itself, I think the government is doing what it can, but is at a loss as to how to do this effectively. The situation is one that they haven't actually encountered before. So it may take time for the effect of the measures they're putting into place to be felt.
Okay, how would you define the role that the various Christian churches are taking to try to restate the need for Muslim-Christian dialogue and trying to persuade Christians not to indulge in tit-for-tat attacks, you know, not to indulge in retaliation attacks?
Well, they're trying their best, but when you say Christians are involved in retaliation attacks, you're talking about young men who have given up waiting on the government to defend their country, who are now out of the control of the Christian church. It's very much like the Northern Irish situation where people call themselves by a certain denomination as a demarcation, not that they're actually fully following the faith. And that is what we're having now, particularly in the areas where you are seeing some retaliation, which are the areas where either Christians are in the majority, for example, in Plateau State, or they are on a level pegging, which has happened in Kaduna. So people have been watching the bombings, in some cases, week after week after week of churches. People have been seeing the attacks on the Christian community, and also seeing a government that seems to be at a loss to do anything. And this is just the latest of the violence. This violence has been ongoing really off and on since democracy came back to Nigeria. So people have been living with this for decades. And young men are now angry, some of them, and are beginning to think that the only way of protecting the community is to take the law into their own hands. And those are the ones that are committing retaliation most recently. What I'm hearing from some church leaders when they try and plead for peace and for people to be patient, they say, well, we've been listening to you all this time and people have been dying. We're not listening to you people anymore. So we're losing a generation, slowly but surely, because of the impunity that's surrounded religious violence.
I was speaking to Dr. Kadaza Gondwe, an expert on African affairs at the NGO Christian Solidarity Worldwide. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.